He's prospered in South Florida real estate and knows his business. He and his wife have three teenagers in their spacious home. Property taxes on it were $58,000 last year. He drives a fancy import and dresses and looks like money. Frankie's ruse doesn't last long. They step into a 4,000-square-foot space with drying plaster, and Tyler asks, "Now, what was the name of your company?"
"No name, no company. I'm here under false pretenses. But it's still important."
"Are you a cop?"
"Anything but. I'm an ex-con who spent 14 years in a Georgia prison for somebody else's murder. A young lawyer took my case and proved I was innocent. Got me exonerated. And dear old Georgia forked over some cash. My record is clean. From time to time I work for the lawyer. Figure it's the least I can do."
"Is this by chance related to Quincy Miller?"
"It is. The lawyer now represents him. We know he's innocent, as do you."
He gives a deep breath and actually smiles. But only for a moment. He walks to a large front window and Frankie follows him. They watch an asphalt crew pave the parking lot. Tyler asks, "And your name?"
"Frankie Tatum."
He hands over a Guardian business card, and Tyler examines both sides. He asks, "So how's Quincy doing?"
"It's been 22 years. I did only 14 as an innocent man. Somehow managed to keep my sanity. But every day is another nightmare."
Tyler hands the card back, as if he's removing the evidence. "Look, I really don't have time for any of this. I don't know what you want, but I'm not getting involved, okay? Sorry and all that, but Quincy is a closed chapter in my book."
"You were a hell of a lawyer, Tyler. You were just a rookie, but you fought for Quincy."
He smiles, shrugs, and says, "And I lost. I'll ask you to leave now."
"Sure. Your property and all. My boss is a lawyer named Cullen Post. Check him out. He's exonerated 8 people, and he didn't do that by taking no for an answer. He wants to talk to you, Tyler. Somewhere private. Very private. Believe me, Tyler, Post knows the game, and he ain't going away. You can save a lot of time and trouble if you'll just meet with him for 15 minutes.
"And he's in Savannah?"
"No. He's across the street."
Frankie points in my direction. The three of us walk around the corner to a family-style restaurant that Tyler's company is building. It's unfinished and workers are taking chairs out of boxes. The avenue beyond is choked with new buildings, car dealerships, fast food huts and drive-thrus, strip malls, a car wash, gas stations, a couple of branch banks. Florida sprawl at its finest. We stand in a corner, away from the workers, and Tyler says, "Okay, let's have it." I get the impression that this conversation may end abruptly, so I ditch the small talk with, "Is it possible to prove Quincy is innocent?" He considers this and shakes his head. "Look, I'm not getting involved in this. Years ago, I tried my best to prove his innocence and I failed. That was another life. Now I have 3 kids, a beautiful wife, money, no worries. I'm not going back there. Sorry."
"Where's the danger, Tyler?"
"Oh, you'll find out. I mean, I hope not, for your sake anyway. But you're walking into a bad situation, Mr. Post." "All of my cases are bad situations." He grunts as if I have no idea. "Nothing like this." "We're about the same age, Tyler. And we quit the law at the same time because we were disillusioned. My second career didn't exactly work, and then I found a new calling. I spend my time pounding the streets, looking for a break, looking for help. Right now, Tyler, Quincy needs your help."
He takes a deep breath and has had enough. I suppose you have to be pushy in your line of work, but I'm not getting pushed, Mr. Post. Good day. Leave me alone and don't come back. He turns around and walks out the door. Not surprisingly, Chad Fallwright digs in. He will not agree to DNA testing of the other six pubic hairs. He now has them under lock and key, along with the other evidence. And to show what a tough prosecutor he really is, he's threatening to have me indicted for tampering. Alabama prohibits it, as do all states, though with varying penalties, and he gleefully writes that I could face up to a year in jail. Locked up over one lousy pubic hair. In addition, he says he plans to file ethics complaints against me with the Alabama and Georgia Bar Associations. I laugh at this. I've been threatened before, and by far more creative prosecutors. Mazie prepares a thick petition for post-conviction relief. Procedurally, it has to be filed first in state court in Verona. The day before we file it, I drive to Birmingham and meet with Jim Bisco, a veteran reporter who covered Duke's trial. He followed the case as the appeals dragged on and expressed doubts about the fairness of the trial. He was especially harsh with his criticism of Duke's defense lawyer. When the poor guy died of cirrhosis, Jim covered it and suggested that another investigation into the murder would be appropriate. He is delighted by the news that the DNA testing has cleared Duke. I'm careful not to name Mark Carter as the killer. That will come later. The day after we filed the petition, Bisco runs a lengthy article that lands on the front page of the Metro section. Chad Fallwright is quoted as saying, "I remain confident that we got the right man, and I'm working diligently to bring about the execution of Duke Russell, a ruthless killer. DNA testing means nothing in this case." After two more conversations with Otis Walker, both by phone, Frankie is convinced that June Walker wants nothing to do with Quincy Miller. Obviously, their chaotic divorce left permanent scars, and she is adamant in her determination not to get involved. There's nothing in it for her except bad memories and the embarrassment of confronting old lies. Otis warns Frankie to leave them alone. He promises to do so. For now. Chapter 17. There are 23 lawyers working in Seabrook these days, and we have a thin file on each of them. About half were in town when Russo was murdered. The senior barrister is a 91-year-old gentleman who still drives himself to the office every day. Two rookies showed up last year and hung out a shingle. All are white, six are female. The most prosperous appear to be a couple of brothers who've spent 20 years doing bankruptcies. Most of the local bar seems to be barely hanging on, same as in most small towns. Glenn Colacurchy once served in the Florida Senate. His district covered Ruiz County and two others, and he was in his third term at the time of the murder. Keith Russo was a distant relative. Both came from the same Italian neighborhood in Tampa. In his younger years, Colacurchy ran the biggest law firm in town and hired Keith out of law school. When he showed up in Seabrook, he brought a wife with him, but Colacurchy had no position for her. Keith didn't last long, and a year later, the Russo firm was founded in a two-room walk-up above a bakery on Main Street. I select Colacurchy because his file is slightly thicker, and because he'll probably know more about Keith. Of all the active lawyers in town, he'll have a better recollection of history. On the phone, he says he can spare half an hour. Driving through Seabrook for the first time, I feel as though I know the place. There are not that many points of interest: the office building once owned by Keith and Diana, and the place where the crime occurred, the street behind it where Carrie Holland claimed to have seen a black man making his escape, the courthouse. I park across from it on Main Street and sit and watch the languid foot traffic. I wonder how many of these people remember the murder. How many knew Keith Russo, Quincy Miller? Do they know the town got it wrong and sent an innocent man to prison? Of course not. When it's time, I join them on the sidewalk and go half a block to the office. In thick black letters of peeling paint, the sign on the windows say Colakirchy Law Firm. An old bell jingles on the door as I step inside. An ancient tabby cat slides off a sofa and disturbs a layer of dust. To my right is a roll-top desk with a manual Underwood typewriter, as if just waiting for a gray-haired secretary to return and resume pecking away. The smell is of old leather and stale tobacco, not altogether unpleasant, but begging for a good cleaning. Remarkably, though, in the midst of an earlier century, a stunning young Asian woman in a short skirt appears with a smile and says,
"Good morning. May I help you?"
I return the smile and say, "Yes, I'm Cullen Post. I talked to Mr. Colakirchy yesterday, and we agreed to meet this morning." She manages to grin and frown at the same time as she steps to a slightly more modern desk. Quietly, she says,
"He didn't tell me. Sorry. My name is B."
"Is he here?" I ask.
"Sure, I'll get him. He's not that busy."
She smiles again and glides away. A moment later, she waves me back, and I enter the big office where Glenn has held court for decades. He is standing by his desk as if pleased to have a visitor, and we go through quick introductions. He motions to a leather sofa and says to B,
"Fetch us some coffee, please."
He hobbles on a cane to a chair that would hold two people. He's almost 80 and certainly looks it, with extra weight and white beard and a mass of unkempt white hair in bad need of a trimming. At the same time, he looks sort of dapper with a pink bow tie and red suspenders.
"Are you a priest or something?"
he asks, staring at my collar. "Yes, Episcopal." I give him the quick version of Guardian Ministries. As I talk, he rests his fuzzy chin on the grip of his cane and absorbs every word with piercing green, though apparently bloodshot, eyes. B brings the coffee, and I take a sip. Lukewarm, probably instant. When she leaves and closes the door, he asks,
"What exactly is a priest doing, sticking his nose into an old case like Quincy Miller?"
"Great question. I wouldn't be here if I didn't think he is innocent." This amuses him.
"Interesting," he mumbles. "I've never had a problem with Miller's conviction. There was an eyewitness, as I remember."
"There were no witnesses. A young woman named Carrie Holland testified she saw a black man running away from the scene, carrying what was implied to have been a shotgun. She lied. She was a druggie who cut a deal with the authorities to avoid jail. She has now admitted she lied, and she wasn't the only liar at trial." He takes his fingers and sweeps back his long hair. It's oily and appears to be unwashed.
"Interesting.
Were you close to Keith?" A grunt in frustration and half a smile.
"What do you want from me?"
"Just background. Did you watch a trial?"
"No. Wanted to, but they moved it next door to Butler County. I was in the Senate back then and pretty busy. Had 7 lawyers working around here, biggest firm in these parts. And I couldn't exactly spend my time sitting in a courtroom watching other lawyers."
"Keith was a relative, right?"
"Sort of. Quite distant. I knew his people down in Tampa. He pestered me for a job, and I gave him one. But he never fit. He wanted me to hire his wife, too, but I didn't want to." He hung around here for a year or so, then struck out on his own. I didn't like that. Italians place a premium on loyalty.
Was he a good lawyer?
Why is that important now?
Just curious. Quincy says that Keith did a terrible job handling his divorce, and the court file tends to support this. The prosecutor played up their conflict to prove motive, which is kind of a stretch. I mean, a client is so disgruntled he blows off in his lawyer's face.
Never happened to me, he says and roars with laughter. I gamely laugh along. But I've had my share of crazy clients. Had a guy show up one time with a gun, years ago, pissed off over a divorce. At least he said he had a gun. Every lawyer in the building had a weapon, and it could have been ugly, but a cute little secretary calmed him down. I've always believed in cute secretaries.
Old lawyers would rather tell war stories than eat lunch, and I would like nothing better than to get him cranked up. I say, you had a big firm back then.
Big for this part of the state. 7, 8, sometimes 10 lawyers, a dozen secretaries, offices upstairs, clients lined up out the front door. It was pretty crazy back in those days, but I got tired of all the drama. I spent half my time refereeing my employees. You ever practiced?
I'm practicing now. Just a different specialty. Years ago, I worked as a public defender but burned out. I found God, and He led me to the seminary. I became a minister, and through an outreach program, met an innocent man in prison. That changed my life.
You get him out?
I did. Then 7 more. I'm working on 6 cases now, including Quincy's.
I read somewhere that maybe 10% of all people locked up are innocent. You believe that?
10% might be on the high side, but there are thousands of innocent people in prison.
I'm not sure I believe that.
Most white folks don't. But go to the black community and you'll find plenty of believers. In his 18 years in the state senate, Colakirchie voted consistently on the side of law and order, pro-death penalty, pro-gun rights, a real drug warrior, and big spender for whatever the state police and prosecutors wanted. He says,
I never had the stomach for criminal law. Can't make any money there.
But Keith made money on the criminal side, didn't he? He glares at me with a frown, as if I've stepped out of bounds. Eventually, he says,
Keith's been dead for over 20 years. Why are you so interested in his law practice?
Because my client didn't kill him. Someone else did. Someone with a different motive. We know Keith and Diana were representing drug dealers in the late 80s, had some clients in the Tampa area. Those guys make good suspects.
Maybe. But I doubt if they'll do much talking after all these years.
Were you close to Sheriff Fitzner? He glares at me again. In a not-so-subtle way, I've just linked Fitzner to the drug dealers, and Colakirchie knows where I'm fishing. He takes a deep breath, exhales loudly, says,
Bradley and I were never close. He ran his show, I ran mine. We were both after the same votes, but we dodged each other. I didn't mess with the criminal side, so our paths seldom crossed.
Where is he now? I asked.
Dead, I presume. He left here years back.
He's not dead, but living a good life in the Florida Keys. He retired after 32 years as sheriff and moved away. His 3-bedroom condo in Marathon is assessed at $1.6 million. Not a bad retirement for a public servant who never earned more than $60,000 a year.
You're thinking Fitzner was somehow involved with Keith?
He asks. Oh, no. Didn't mean to imply that. Oh, yes. But Colakirchie is not taking the bait. He narrows his eyes and says,
This eyewitness, she says Fitzner convinced her to lie on the stand.
If and when Carrie Holland recants her false testimony, it will be included in a court filing for everyone to see. However, I'm not ready to reveal anything to this guy. I say, look, Mr. Colakirchy, this is all confidential, right?
Of course,
he readily agrees. He was a stranger until about 15 minutes ago, and he'll probably be on the phone before I get to my vehicle. She didn't name Fitzer, just said it was the cops and prosecutor. I have no reason to suspect Fitzner of anything.
That's good. This murder was solved 20 years ago. You're spinning your wheels, Mr. Post.
Maybe. How well did you know Diana Russo? He rolls his eyes as if she was the last subject he wants to discuss.
Not well at all. I kept my distance from the beginning. She wanted a job, but back then we didn't hire girls. She took it as an insult and never liked me. She soured Keith on me, and we never got along. I was relieved when he left, though I wasn't finished with him. He became a real pain in the ass.
In what way? He gazes at the ceiling as if debating whether or not to tell me a story. Being an old lawyer, he can't help himself.
Well, this is what happened,
he begins as he shifts weight and settles in for the narrative.
Back in the day, I had all the tort business sewed up in Ruiz County. All the good car wrecks, bad products, med mal, bad faith, everything. If a person got injured, they showed up here, or sometimes I went to see them in the hospital. Keith wanted some of the action because it's no secret that injuries are the only way to make money out there on the streets. Big firm guys in Tampa do okay, but nothing like big tort lawyers. When Keith left my office, he stole a case, took it with him, and we had one hell of a fight. He was broke and needed the cash, but the case belonged to my firm. I threatened to sue him, and we fought for 2 years. He eventually agreed to give me half the fee. But there was bad blood. Diana was in the middle of it, too.
Law firms blow up every week, and it's always over money. Did you and Keith ever reconcile?
Sort of, I guess. But it took years. It's a small town, and the lawyers generally get along. We had lunch the week before he was murdered and had a laugh or two. Keith was a good boy who worked hard, maybe a bit too ambitious. I never warmed up to her, though. But you had to feel sorry for her. Poor girl found her husband with his face blown off. Handsome guy, too. She took it hard, never recovered. Sold the building and eventually left town.
No contact since then?
None whatsoever.
He glances at his watch as if he's facing another hectic day, and the hint is clear. We wind down the conversation, and after 30 minutes, I thank him and leave. Chapter 18. Bradley Fitzner ruled the county for 32 years before retiring. During his career, he avoided scandal and ran a tight operation. Every 4 years, he was either unopposed or faced light opposition. He was succeeded by a deputy who served 7 years before bad health forced him out. The current sheriff is Wink Castle, and his office is in a modern metal building that houses all local law enforcement, sheriff, city police, and jail. A dozen brightly painted patrol cars are parked in front of the building at the edge of town. The lobby is busy with cops and clerks and sad relatives checking on inmates. I'm led to Castle's office, and he greets me with a smile and firm handshake. He's about 40. And has the easy manner of a rural politician. He did not live in the county at the time of the Russo murder, so hopefully he carries no baggage from those days. After a few minutes of weather talk, he says,
Quincy Miller, huh? I looked through the file last night to get up to speed. Are you a
priest or something?
A lawyer and a minister, I say, and spend a moment talking about guardian. I take old cases that involve the innocent.
Good luck with this one.
I smile and say, they're all difficult, Sheriff.
Got it. So how do you plan to prove that your client did not kill Keith Russo?
Well, as always, I go back to the scene and start digging. I know that most of the state's witnesses lied at trial. The evidence is shaky at best.
Zeke Huffy?
Typical jailhouse snitch. I found him in prison in Arkansas, and I expect him to recant. He's made a career out of lying and recanting. Not unusual for those guys. Carrie Holland has already told me the truth. She lied under pressure from Fitzner and Burkhead, the prosecutor. They gave her a good deal on a pending drug charge. After the trial, Fitzner gave her $1,000 and ran her out of town. She hasn't been back. June Walker, Quincy's ex-wife, lives in Tallahassee but so far has refused to cooperate. She testified against Quincy and lied because she was angry over their divorce. Lots of lies, Sheriff. This is all new to him, and he absorbs it with interest. Then he shakes his head and says,
"Still a long way to go. There's no murder weapon."
Right. Quincy never owned a shotgun. The key, obviously, is the blood-spattered flashlight that mysteriously disappeared not long after the murder.
"What happened to it?" he asks.
"He's the sheriff. I should be asking him."
"You tell me."
The official version, according to Fitzner, is that it was destroyed in a fire where they kept evidence.
"You doubt that?"
"I doubt everything, Sheriff. The expert for the state, a Mr. Norwood, never saw the flashlight. His testimony was pretty outrageous." I reach into my briefcase, pull out some papers, and place them on his desk. "This is our summary of the evidence. In there you'll see a report from a Dr. Kyle Benderschmidt, a renowned criminologist, that raises serious doubts about Norwood's testimony. Have you looked at the photographs of the flashlight?"
"Yes."
"Dr. Benderschmidt believes that the specks, or flecks, on the lens are probably not even human blood. And the flashlight was not found at the scene. We're not sure where it came from, and Quincy swears he had never seen it." He takes the report and takes his time flipping through it. When he gets bored, he tosses it onto his desk and says,
"I'll spend some time with it tonight. What exactly do you want me to do here?"
"Help me. I'll file a petition for post-conviction relief based on new evidence. It will have reports from our experts and statements from the witnesses who lied. I need for you to reopen the investigation into the murder. It will be a tremendous help if the court knows that the locals believe the wrong man was convicted."
"Come on, Mr. Post. This case was closed over 20 years ago, long before I came to town."
"They're all old cases, Sheriff, old and cold. That's the nature of our work. Most of the actors are gone. Fitzner, Burkhead, even the judge is dead. You can look at the case with a fresh perspective and help get an innocent man out of prison." He's shaking his head.
"I don't think so. I can't see getting involved in this. Hell, I never thought about the case until you called yesterday."
"All the more reason to get involved. You can't be blamed for anything that went wrong 20 years ago. You'll be seen as the good guy trying to do the right thing."
"Do you have to find the real killer to get Miller out?"
"No. I have to prove him innocent, that's all. In about half of our cases, we manage to nail the real criminal, but not always." He keeps shaking his head. The smiles are gone.
"I can't see it, Mr. Post. I mean, you expect me to pull one of my overworked detectives off his active cases and start digging through a 20-year-old murder that folks round here have forgotten about. Come on, man.
I'll do the heavy lifting, Sheriff. That's my job.
So what's my job?
Cooperate. Don't get in the way. He leans back in his chair and locks his hands behind his head. He stares at the ceiling as minutes pass. Finally, he asks,
"In your cases, what do the locals normally do?"
"Cover up, stonewall, hide evidence, fight me like hell, contest everything I file in court. You see, Sheriff, in these cases, the stakes are too high and the mistakes are too egregious for anyone to admit they were wrong. Innocent men and women serve decades while the real killers roam free and often kill again. These are enormous injustices, and I've yet to find a cop or a prosecutor with the spine to admit they blew it. This case is a bit different because those responsible for Quincy's wrongful conviction are gone. You can be the hero."
"I'm not interested in being a hero. I just cannot justify spending the time. Believe me, I've got enough to worry about."
"Sure you do. But you can cooperate and make my job easier. I'm just searching for the truth here, Sheriff."
"I don't know. Let me think about it."
"That's all I ask. For now, anyway." He takes a deep breath, still unconvinced and definitely uncommitted to the cause.
"Anything else?"
"Well, there is one other matter. Another possible piece of the puzzle. Are you familiar with the death of Kenny Taft? Happened about 2 years after the murder."
"Sure. He was the last officer killed on duty. His photo is hanging on the wall out there."
"I'd like to see the case file without having to go through the Freedom of Information Act and all that crap."
"And you think it was somehow related to Quincy Miller?"
"I doubt it. But I'm just digging, Sheriff. That's what I do. And there are always surprises along the way."
"Let me think about it."
"Thanks." The fire chief is a pot-bellied, grizzled old veteran who goes by Lieutenant Jordan and is not nearly as friendly as the sheriff. Things are slow around the firehouse 2 blocks off Main Street. 2 of his men polish a shiny pumper in the driveway, and inside an ancient secretary fiddles with paperwork on her desk. Jordan eventually appears, and after a brief round of forced pleasantries, leads me to a cramped room with banks of 1940s-style file cabinets. For a moment, he searches through history and finds the drawer for 1988. He opens it, flips through a row of dingy files, finds what I'm after, and pulls it out.
"Not much of a fire, as I recall,"
he says as he places it on the table.
"Help yourself."
He leaves the room. Back then, the sheriff's office was several blocks away in an old building that has since been razed. In Ruiz County, as in hundreds of other places, it was not at all unusual to store crime scene evidence anywhere there happened to be an empty space or closet. I've crawled through courthouse attics and suffocating basements in search of old records. To alleviate the shortage of storage space, Fitzner used a portable shed behind his office. In the file, there is a black and white photo of it before the fire, and a heavy padlock on the only door is visible. There were no windows. I estimate it was 30 feet long, 12 feet wide, 8 feet in height. A photo taken after the fire shows nothing but charred rubble. The first alarm came at 3:10 a.m., and the firemen found the shed fully engulfed. The fire was extinguished in a matter of minutes, with nothing salvageable. Its cause is listed as unknown. As Jordan said, it wasn't much of a fire. The flashlight found in Quincy's trunk was apparently destroyed. No trace was found. Conveniently, the autopsy reports, witness statements,
diagrams, and photos were safely locked away inside Fitzner's desk. He had what he needed to convict Quincy Miller. For the moment, the fire is a dead end. Chapter 19. I call Carrie and Buck once a week to check on them. They realize I'm not going away and are slowly coming around. I repeatedly assure her that she runs no risks by cooperating with me, and we establish a level of trust. We meet in a coffee shop near Kingsport and eat omelets. She reads the affidavit Maisie has prepared. Then Buck goes through it slowly. I answer the same questions about what happens next and so on, and after an hour of gentle cajoling, she signs it. In the parking lot, I give her a hug, and Buck wants one too. We're trusted pals now, and I thank them for having the courage to help Quincy. Through tears, she asks me to ask him to forgive her. "It's already done," I reply. My mother inherited the family farm near Dyersburg, Tennessee, my hometown. Mom is 73 and has lived by herself since Dad died 2 years ago. I worry about her because of her age, though she is healthier than me and not at all lonely. She worries about me because of my nomadic lifestyle and absence of a serious romantic relationship. She has grudgingly accepted the reality that starting a family is not one of my priorities, and I am not likely to produce more grandchildren. My sister has given her 3, but they live far away. She doesn't eat animals and is sustained by the land. Her garden is legendary and could feed hundreds, and in fact, does. She hauls baskets of fresh fruits and vegetables to the local food bank. We dine on tomatoes stuffed with rice and mushrooms, thick butter beans, and a squash casserole. In spite of the abundance, she eats like a bird and drinks nothing but tea and water. She is fit and spry and refuses to take pills, and as she pushes her vegetables around her plate, she encourages me to eat more. She is concerned about my lack of weight, but I wave her off. I hear this from others. Afterwards, we sit on the front porch and drink mint tea. Little has changed on the porch since my convalescence many years ago, and we talk about those dark days. We also talk about Brooke, my ex. They were fond of each other and kept in touch for years. Mom was angry with her at first for leaving me during my breakdown, but I finally convinced her that our split had been inevitable on our wedding day. Brooke married an entrepreneur who has done well. They have 4 children, beautiful teenagers, and Mom gets a bit wistful when she thinks about what might have been. As soon as I get an opening, I move the conversation in another direction. In spite of my unconventional lifestyle, Mom is proud of what I do, though she understands little about the criminal justice system. She finds it depressing that there is so much crime, so many people imprisoned, so many broken families. It has taken me years to convince her that there are thousands of innocent people locked away. This is our first chance to talk about Quincy Miller, and she loves getting the details. A murdered lawyer, a crooked sheriff, a drug cartel, an innocent man perfectly framed. She can't believe it at first and relishes the story. I don't worry about telling her too much. We are, after all, sitting on a dark porch in rural Tennessee, far away from Florida, and who would she tell anyway? I can trust my mom to keep secrets. We go through each of my other clients. Shasta Briley on death row in North Carolina, convicted of arson that killed her 3 daughters. Billy Rayburn in Tennessee, convicted by the dubious science of what has become known as the shaken baby syndrome after he tripped and fell while holding his girlfriend's baby. Duke Russell, still on death row in Alabama, Curtis Wallace, convicted in Mississippi of the abduction, rape, and murder of a young woman he never met, and little Jimmy Flagler, who was 17 and mentally retarded when Georgia locked him away for life. These six cases are my life and career. I live with them every day, and I often tire of thinking and talking about them. I ease the conversation back to Mom and ask how her poker game is going. She plays once a week with a group of lady friends, and though the stakes are small, it's cutthroat competition. She's currently up $11.50. They settle their debts at Christmas with a party where they break bad and consume alcohol, cheap champagne. With another group, she plays bridge twice a month, but she prefers poker. She is in two book clubs, one with church ladies and they stick to theology, and the other with looser friends who prefer popular fiction, sometimes even trash. She teaches a Sunday school class, reads to seniors at a retirement home, and volunteers with more nonprofits than she can name. She just bought an electric car and explains in detail what makes it run. Several times each year, Frankie Tatum stops by for dinner. They are close friends, and she loves cooking for him. He was here last week, and she talks about his visit. She is quite proud of the fact that he would still be locked away if not for me. This shifts the conversation back to my work. At one time, she wanted me to get through this phase and move on to a more sustainable career. Maybe in a real law firm, but those conversations are over. Her pensions provide a comfortable life. She does not do debt, and she sends Guardian a small check each month. She goes to bed promptly at 10 o'clock and sleeps for 8 uninterrupted hours. She leaves me on the porch with a kiss on the head. And I sit wide-eyed for hours on this cool, quiet night and think of my clients sleeping on cramped bunks and cots behind bars. Innocent people. Chapter 20. Acting on a tip, the guards raided Zeke Huffy's cell a month ago and found a shank, a homemade knife. Drugs are routinely found in raids and are dealt with casually. But a weapon is a serious offense because it is such a threat to the guards. Zeke is spending time in the Cave, an underground unit used to punish offenders with solitary confinement. His dreams of being paroled early are gone. Instead, he'll serve additional time. I'm met at a front office by a man in a suit, a deputy warden of some variety, and along with a guard, I'm whisked through security and led to a building away from the prisoners' units. The deputy warden nods and frowns, and doors open immediately. The right strings are being pulled. I walk down some concrete stairs and into a square, damp, windowless room. Zeke is waiting in a metal chair with leg irons locked to the floor. There is no partition between us. His hands are free, and after a momentary shock of seeing me, he offers a limp handshake. When the guard leaves and slams the door, Zeke asks, "What are you doing here?" "I'm here for a visit, Zeke. I've missed you." He grunts and can't think of a response. Residents of the Cave are not allowed visitors. I pull out a pack of cigarettes and ask, "Want to smoke?" "Hell yes," he says. Suddenly the addict again. I hand him one and notice his shaking hands. I light it with a match. He closes his eyes and sucks hard in a mighty effort to consume it with one fierce pull. He blows a cloud of smoke at the ceiling and hits it again. After three, he flicks ashes on the floor and manages a smile.
"How'd you get in here, Post? This hole is off limits."
"I know. Got a friend down in Little Rock." He burns it down to the filter,
thumps the butt against the wall, says, "How about another one?" I light another cigarette. He is pale and gaunt, even thinner than the last time I saw him, and he has a new tattoo across his throat. The nicotine calms him, and most of the shaking stops. I say, "They plan to add a few months to your time here, Zeke." Pretty stupid, hiding a shank like that.
"Most of what I do can be classified as stupid, Post. You know that. Smart people don't live like this."
"True. Quincy Miller is a smart guy, Zeke, and he's been locked away for a long time because of you. It's time to set the boy free, don't you think?" We've swapped a few letters since my last visit, and Guardian sent another small check. However, from the tone of his correspondence, he is not ready to admit he lied. He considers himself to be in charge of our fragile relationship and will manipulate it from every angle.
"Oh, I don't know, Post. It was a long time ago. Not sure I remember all the details."
"I have the details here in an affidavit, Zeke. One I want you to sign. Remember an old pal named Shiner, another junkie you served time with in Georgia?" He smiles and replies,
"Sure, I remember Shiner. What a loser."
"And he remembers you. We found him near Atlanta, and he's doing okay. Much better than you. Got himself cleaned up and so far has stayed out of trouble. We have an affidavit signed by him in which he says the two of you often bragged about your careers as jailhouse informants. Says you laughed about Quincy Miller and the Preston kid and Dothan still serving time. And Shiner says you always got a kick out of your performance in a murder trial in Gulfport. Kelly Morris, now serving life because of you." "We verified these cases, Zeke. Read the transcripts with your testimony. Shiner is telling the truth for a change." He glares at me, flicks more ashes.
"So what?"
"So it's time for you to come clean and help Quincy. It's no skin off your balls, Zeke. You're not going anywhere. As I've said before several times, the folks in Florida forgot about you a long time ago. They couldn't care less if you now admit you lied about Quincy." He thumps the remainder of number two and asks for number three. I light it for him. He pulls hard, adds to the fog above our heads, says sarcastically,
"Gee, I don't know, Post. I'm worried about my reputation."
"Very funny, but I wouldn't waste much time worrying about that. I have a deal for you, Zeke. One that will last for 15 minutes, then disappear forever. As I said, I have a friend down in Little Rock, one with some clout. Otherwise, I wouldn't be sitting here right now. No one in the cave gets visits, right?" So the deal goes something like this. Arkansas plans to add an additional 6 months to your time, punishment for the shank. That adds up to another 21 months in this dump. My friend can make it go away. All but 3 months. A year and a half can vanish into thin air. All you have to do is sign the affidavit. He puffs, flicks, stares at me in disbelief.
"You gotta be kidding."
"And why would I be kidding? You do what you should do anyway as a decent human being, something you're not, and we both know it, and Quincy gets a break.
Ain't no judge going to let him out just because I come along 20 years later and say I lied, Post. Come on."
"Let me worry about that. Every piece of evidence helps in these cases, Zeke. You probably don't remember a witness named Carrie Holland. She lied, too. But the difference is that she now has the guts to admit it. I have her affidavit, if you'd like to see it. A woman with courage, Zeke. It's time to man up, big boy, and tell the truth for a change.
You know, Pose, I was just starting to like you."
"Don't bother. I'm not that likable and really don't care. My mission is to untangle the web of lies that convicted Quincy.
You want 18 months knocked off or not? How can I trust you?
The word trust doesn't sound right coming from you, Zeke.
I'm an honest man. I don't lie. I guess you'll just have to roll the dice. Give me another.
I light the fourth cigarette. He is calm now, calculating. Says,
this deal, can you put it in writing?
No, it doesn't work that way. Every prison in Arkansas is overcrowded, and the state needs some relief. The county jails are backed up, some sleeping six to a cell, and the powers that be are looking for space. They don't care what happens to you.
You got that right.
I glance at my watch. They promised me 30 minutes, Zeke. Time's about up. Deal or no deal? He thinks and smokes.
How long do I stay in the cave?
You'll get out tomorrow, I promise. He nods, and I hand him the affidavit. Assuming he doesn't read much, the wording is simple. Nothing more than three syllables. With a cigarette screwed into the corner of his mouth and smoke burning his eyes, he reads it carefully. Ashes fall onto his shirt, and he swats them away. After the last page, he tosses the butt and says,
I got no problem with this.
I hand him a pen.
You promise me, Post?
I promise. The leading death penalty lawyer in Arkansas is a friend I worked with on another case. His wife's first cousin is a state senator, chairman of the Appropriations Committee, and thus in charge of funding all agencies, including corrections. I don't like working the favor bank because I have so little to give in return, but in this business, I'm forced to network. Occasionally something clicks and a miracle happens. Leaving the cotton fields of northeastern Arkansas, I call Vicky with the news. She is thrilled and runs to tell Maisie. Once the nightmare of Quincy was behind her, June married again. Her second effort with a man named James Rode was slightly less chaotic than her first, but didn't last long. She was still a mess at that point, emotionally unstable and doing drugs. Frankie found Rode in Pensacola. He had nothing nice to say about his ex-wife, and over a few beers, delivered the story we were hoping for. They lived together before they married, and during that brief period of romance and bliss, they drank too much and smoked crack, but always away from the kids. On several occasions, June laughed about Quincy, a man she would loathe forever. She confided in Rode that she had lied to help put him away, and that the lies were encouraged by Sheriff Fitzner and Forrest Burkhead, the prosecutor. Rode was reluctant to get involved, but Frankie knows persistence. It's part of our culture. Ease in, get to know the witnesses, develop a level of trust, and always gently remind them that an innocent man has been wronged by the system. In this case, by white folks in a small backward town. Frankie assured Rode that he had done nothing wrong and would face no trouble. June had lied, and she was unwilling to acknowledge the damage she had done. He, Rode, could help immeasurably. In another bar and over another round of beers, he agreed to sign an affidavit. Chapter 21. For the past 3 months, our work has been done as quietly as possible. If the men who killed Keith Russo know we're digging, we're not aware of it. This changes when we file our petition for post-conviction relief on behalf of Quincy Miller. Maisie's brief is an inch thick, beautifully written, and skillfully argued, as always. It begins with a thorough dismantling of Paul Norwood's expert testimony about bloodstain analysis. She attacks his credentials and says unkind things about him. In excruciating detail, She goes through the 7 cases where he pointed the finger at innocent men who were later exonerated by DNA testing. She drives home the point that these 7 men served a total of 98 years in prison, but none as long as Quincy Miller. Once Maisie's brief has Norwood drowning in his own blood, she charges in with the real science and Kyle Benderschmidt takes the stage. His impeccable credentials are presented and contrasted with the state's expert. His report begins with incredulity. The flashlight is the only link to Quincy, and it was not recovered from the crime scene. There is no proof whatsoever that it was actually present during the shooting. There is no proof that the tiny flecks on the lens are actually human blood. It is impossible to determine from the photographs if the little orange dots are really blood samples. It is impossible to determine the angle of the gunshots. It is impossible to know how the killer held the flashlight as he was firing away, if indeed he held it at all. Lots of impossibilities. Norwood's testimony was factually wrong, scientifically unproven, contrary to reason, and legally irresponsible. Norwood assumed crucial facts that were not in evidence, and when confronted with unknowns, he simply fabricated more testimony. The summary of Benderschmidt's findings is compelling, convincing, and constitutes new evidence. But there's more. Our second expert is Dr. Tobias Black, a renowned criminologist in San Francisco. Working independently of Dr. Benderschmidt, Dr. Black studied the photos and exhibits and read the trial transcript. His disdain for Norwood and his fellow pseudoscientists is hardly controlled. His conclusions are the same. Maisie writes like a Nobel laureate, and when she's armed with the facts, she is unassailable. I don't want her angry at me if I commit a crime. She criticizes the investigation of Sheriff Fitzner. Using the Freedom of Information Act, Vicki obtained records from the Florida State Police. In a memo, an investigator complained of Fitzner's heavy-handedness in his efforts to maintain sole and complete control of the case. He did not want outside interference and refused to cooperate. With no physical evidence linking Quincy to the crime, it became imperative for Fitzner to create his own. Without notifying the state police, he obtained a search warrant for Quincy's car and rather conveniently found the flashlight in its trunk. The brief then moves to the lying witnesses and includes the affidavits from Carrie Holland Pruitt, Zeke Huffey, Tucker Shiner, and James Rode. Maisie is restrained but almost cruel in her treatment of the liars, and she rages on with a blistering commentary on the use of snitch testimony in American prosecutions. Next, she analyzes the issue of motive and makes much of the fact that Quincy's alleged grudge against Keith Russo was more anecdotal than factual. She presents an affidavit from the law firm's former receptionist, who says she remembers only one visit by the disgruntled client, who was mildly perturbed. But he made no threats and left when she informed him that Keith was not in his office. She does not remember the second and more threatening visit that Diana Russo described to the jury. The police were never called. Indeed, there was no record of anyone at the firm complaining about Quincy's behavior. Regarding the phone threats, there was simply no proof. Diana blocked the defense's efforts to obtain the couple's phone records, and they have since been destroyed. The last section of the brief covers Quincy's own testimony. Since he did not testify at trial, he is now able to tell his story with his own affidavit. He denies any involvement, denies ever owning or firing a 12-gauge shotgun, and denies knowing anything about the flashlight until photos of it were presented in court. He denies being in Seabrook on the night of the murder. His alibi was and remains his old girlfriend, Valerie Cooper, who has never budged from her testimony that he was with her that night. We attach an affidavit from Valerie. The brief is 54 pages of clear, sound reasoning and leaves little doubt, at least in the minds of the fine folks at Guardian Ministries, that Florida got the wrong man. It should be read by learned and fair-minded judges who should be appalled and move quickly to correct an injustice, but that never happens. We file it quietly and wait. After 3 days, it becomes obvious that the press has no interest, and that's fine with us. After all, the case has been closed for 22 years. Since I am not licensed to practice law in Florida, we associate Susan Ashley Gross, an old friend who runs the Central Florida Innocence Project. Her name is listed first on the pleadings above mine and Maisie's. Our representation is now public record. I send a copy of our petition and brief to Tyler Townsend and hope for a response. Over in Alabama, Chad Fallwright makes good on his promise to seek justice for me and not the real killer. He files an ethics complaint with the Alabama Bar, of which I am not a member, and one in Georgia, where my license is registered. Chad wants me disbarred for tampering with the evidence, for borrowing a pubic hair. I've been through this before. It's a hassle and can be intimidating, but I can't slow down. Duke Russell is still serving time for Mark Carter, and this keeps me awake at night. I call a lawyer friend in Birmingham, and he's itching for a fight. Maisie will take care of the complaint in Georgia. I'm in the conference room upstairs working through a pile of desperate letters from prison when Maisie yells. I bound down the stairs and step into her office where she and Vicky are staring at her desktop screen. The message is in a bold, silly font that's almost difficult to read, but the message is clear. Your filing in Poinsett County makes for interesting reading, but it never mentions Kenny Taft. Maybe he wasn't shot by drug dealers. Maybe he knew too much. This message will evaporate 5 minutes after being opened. It cannot be traced. Don't bother. We gawk at it until it slowly fades away and the page goes blank. Vicky and I back into chairs and stare at the walls. Maisie is pecking away and finally says,
"It's a site called From Under Patty's Porch. For $20 a month with a credit card, you get 30 days access to a private chat room where messages are confidential, temporary, and cannot be traced."
I have no idea what she's talking about. She pecks some more and says,
"Looks legitimate and probably harmless. A lot of these servers are in Eastern Europe where the privacy rules are stricter." "Can we reply?"
Vicky asks. "Do we want to?" I ask. Maisie says,
"Yes, we can reply for $20. "It's not in the budget," Vicky says. "This person is using the address of cassius.clay.444. We could pay up and send him a note."
"Not now," I say. He doesn't want to talk, and he's not going to say anything. Let's think about this. Anonymous tips are part of the game, and they provide an excellent way to waste a lot of time. Kenny Taft was 27 years old when he was killed in a remote part of Ruiz County in 1990. He was the only black deputy on Fitchner's force and had worked there for 3 years. He and his partner Gilmer were dispatched by Fitchner to a site believed to be used as a staging point by cocaine smugglers, none of whom were supposed to be in the area. Taft and Gilmer were not expecting trouble. Their mission was a scouting trip, supposedly requested by the DEA office in Tampa. There was only a slight possibility that the site was, in fact, being used, and their job was to take a look and file a report. According to Gilmer, who survived with minor injuries, they were ambushed as they drove slowly along a gravel road at 3 a.m. The woods were thick, and they saw no one. The first shots hit the side of the unmarked car Gilmer was driving. Then the rear windows were blown out. He stopped the car and lunged out and scrambled into a ditch. On the other side, Kenny Taft also bailed out, but was immediately hit in the head and died at the scene. He did not have time to pull his service revolver. When the bullet stopped, Gilmer crawled to his car and called for help. The gunman vanished without a trace. DEA officials believed it was the work of traffickers. Months later, an informant allegedly said the killers did not realize they were dealing with cops. There was a lot of cocaine hidden at the site, just down the road, and they were forced to protect their inventory. The informant allegedly said they were somewhere in South America. Good luck with the search. Chapter 22. I get an angry phone call from Otis Walker. Seems his wife June is upset because her second husband, James Rode, said something bad about her in court. I patiently explain that we have not been to court yet, but we did file an affidavit signed by Rode in which he claims that June laughed about lying in court to Nail Quincy. He called her a liar? Otis asks, as if surprised. In front of a jury? No, no, Mr. Walker, not in a courtroom, just in some papers.
Why'd he do that?
Because we asked him to. We're trying to get Quincy out of prison because he didn't kill that lawyer.
So you're saying my wife June is a liar, right?
We're saying she lied in court way back then.
Same difference. Don't know how y'all can drag up all this old shit after 20 years.
Yes, sir. It's been a long time. Just ask Quincy.
I think I should talk to a lawyer.
You do that. Give him my phone number and I'll be happy to have a chat. But you're wasting your money. From under Patty's porch, Maisie gets the message. The Salty Pelican is an old bar on the Nassau waterfront, Bahamas. Be there next Tuesday at noon. It is important. This message will burn itself 5 minutes after being opened. Don't even think about trying to track it. I grab a credit card, go to Patty's, pay up, log in as joe.frazier.555, and send my message. Should I bring a gun or a bodyguard? 10 minutes later, I get, no. I come in peace. The bar is always crowded, plenty of people around. I reply, who is supposed to recognize the other person? It'll work. Don't get yourself followed. See ya. The debate almost becomes an argument. Maisie is adamant in her belief that I would be foolish to walk into such a meeting with a stranger. Vicky doesn't like it either. I maintain that it's a risk we have to take for reasons that are obvious. The person knows a lot about the case and wants to help. He or she is also frightened enough to meet out of the country, which, at least to me, indicates some really rich dirt could be collected. Outnumbered 2-1, I leave anyway and drive to Atlanta. Vicky is masterful at finding the absolute rock-bottom prices for flights, hotels, and rent-a-wrecks, and she books me on a Bahamian turboprop that stops twice before I leave America. It has only one flight attendant who cannot smile and has no interest in getting out of her jump seat. With no luggage, I'm waved through customs and pick a cab from a long line. It's a vintage 1970s Cadillac with a loud radio blaring Bob Marley for us tourists. The driver smokes a joint to add to the local color. Traffic barely moves, so there is little chance of a deadly crash. We stall in an impressive jam, and I've had enough. I get out, pay him as he points this way and that. The Salty Pelican is an old bar with sagging rafters and a thatched roof. Large, creaky fans drop from the ceiling and offer the slightest of breezes. Genuine Bahamians play a rowdy game of dominoes at a crowded table. They appear to be gambling. Others are tossing darts in a corner. White people outnumber the natives, and it's obviously a popular place for tourists. I get a beer from the bar and sit at a table under an umbrella, 10 feet from the water. I'm wearing sunglasses and a baseball cap, and I'm trying to casually notice things around me. Over the years, I've become a pretty good investigator, but I'm still a lousy spy. If someone is following me, I'll never know. Noon comes and goes as I gaze at the water. A voice behind me says, "Hello, Post." Tyler Townsend eases into the chair beside me.